Welcome to Betrayal Recovery Radio, the official podcast of APSATS, the Association of Partners of Sex Addict Trauma Specialists, hosted by Dr. Jake Porter. APSATS is a nonprofit organization providing professional training and compassionate support to partners affected by problematic sexual behavior and betrayal trauma. In each episode, Dr. Jake guides a conversation of enlightening insights and practical tools to empower those affected by sex addiction and betrayal trauma to use their voices and live their values. The mission of Betrayal Recovery Radio is to offer hope to those in need of healing and growth to those moving through grief. And now, here's your host, Dr. Jake Porter.
Welcome again to Betrayal Recovery Radio. I am your host, Dr. Jake Porter, and I am so grateful that you are joining me. It's a joy, it's a privilege, and an honor to get to do this for APSATS, the Association of Partners of Sex Addict Trauma Specialists. Hey, if you're listening and you're not familiar with APSATS, we really want you to take a minute. Go check us out at our website, APSATS.org, APSATS.org, and learn more about the resources that are there, the trainings that are offered. If you work with folks who have experienced betrayal and the trauma of betrayal, and you haven't done APSATS training, that's really something you've just got to do. And if you're listening and you're someone who is working through those consequences of betrayal, I want to encourage you, if you haven't done it already, to go check out the directory at APSATS.org and look for someone to help you and walk with you through this journey. So listen, today is going to be a sort of follow-up from last week's episode. Last week was more of a monologue on my part. Usually we do conversations here. Last week I talked a lot about grief. I shared some of the clinical conceptions of grief, particularly as it is applied to betrayal and betrayal trauma, and the neurobiology of grief and more. And I got such great results, and people were asking more questions about grief, and I got a lot of questions about how grief impacts not just the individual who's been betrayed, but that individual within the context of their relationship. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to share with you a conversation that I had with one of my colleagues in my practice, Daring Ventures, Dr. Wendell Gill. Dr. Wendell Gill is a pastoral sex addiction professional and pastoral multiple addiction professional. He has an extensive history doing all kinds of stuff. He is still currently pastor of a church. He spent many years in the field of education. And his research for his doctorate was within the field of emotional science, the science of emotion, emotional intelligence, specifically something called emotional labor, which is a great conversation that maybe I'll have with him at another point on this podcast. But Dr. Gill works extensively with addicts. He is excellent at preparing them for disclosures, helping them to remember what's going on, but using that process also to expand emotional capacities, expand the ability to feel and experience and share empathy with their betrayed partners. And in addition to that, he also does some coaching with couples and works on helping with that exchange of emotion within couples. So just last month at the Choose Connection Summit, which I hosted, I had a conversation with Dr. Gill about grief and the process of grief and how that shows up for both betrayed partners, recovering addicts, and within their coupleship. And so as a continuation of last week, I want to offer you the opportunity now to listen in on this conversation with Dr. Wendell Gill. I hope you'll enjoy. Thank you for being a part of this session of the Choose Connection Summit for 2022. I'm Dr. Jake Porter, your host. I'm really excited to introduce you to our guest this session, Dr. Wendell Gill. He is one of my teammates here at Daring Ventures, where he works as a relational coach. He helps addicts walk through the disclosure preparation process and disclosures themselves, and then coaches them toward relational recovery.
He also works with couples, helping them to heal and enrich their relationship through learning intimate vulnerability and improved emotional skills. He's got a Master of Divinity degree from Southwestern Seminary, a Master of Science in Education from the University of Houston Clear Lake, and a Doctorate in Education from Lamar University. He's a faculty member of the Emotional Intelligence Training and Research Institute, and his research in emotional labor was his entry point into the field of addiction recovery. But beyond all of that, I count Wendell as a dear friend of mine and someone who I treasure getting to spend time with and work with. So Wendell, thank you for being here and thank you for letting me do this with you.
Thank you, Jake. And thank you for such a kind introduction. I appreciate that. And I too treasure your friendship and grateful to work alongside you in this field. It's very rewarding and there's always new things to learn. I learned so much working with the gentlemen and couples that I get to work with.
Yeah, they do. They really teach us as much as we teach them. I'm certain of it. Yeah. And you know, Wendell, just for those of you who don't know Wendell, he's really a special guy, and everyone who works with him says so. He leads particularly an aftercare group that mm-hmm. men who go through disclosure can choose to be a part of if they'd like. And it's a really special group, something that we saw missing in the recovery field at large. Rather than a focus on sobriety and traditional recovery issues and topics, which are very important, what Dr. Gill does is he helps them focus on the relational recovery and their relationships with their primary partners. And that group has grown and grown. And Wendell, I know you do great work with those guys.
Yeah, Jake, thanks for mentioning that, because one of the most rewarding things I get to do is to help guys who have certainly, as you mentioned, sobriety is the baseline, right? You can't go forward without sobriety. So the gentlemen I work with are continuing to work the program of recovery. But as you pointed out, that other piece of relational recovery is really a critical piece of their addiction recovery, because that part of addiction itself, which is normally men normally or people generally get addicted to things because they avoid intimacy. They're afraid of it. There's sort of a scared of it, and many times because of attachment wounds, obviously, and trauma wounds perhaps early in life. And so So that piece of helping men go through a very traumatic experience of sharing their whole story for the first time, obviously it's traumatic for them, not near as traumatic as it is for the partner they betrayed, but there is definitely an overwhelming emotional experience that they're going through that's really fraught with a lot of fear. Mm-hmm. And so helping them and coaching them toward the how to connect with their partner whom they betrayed is critical actually to their overall recovery. So there's definitely an intersection of the two kinds of recovery. It's obviously the recovery of the addict, the recovery of the addict, and the recovery of the relationship. So it's challenging, but I'm grateful to see a lot of guys that are just really embracing, sort of offering themselves as children to learn how to be in an intimate relationship. So yeah, it's a wonderful experience working with them.
Yeah,
it absolutely is. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you so much. And we're talking here, focusing primarily here on what happens after disclosure. And in the various models that are out there for healing from trauma and recovery models, and the model that we use here during Ventures, the couple centered recovery model, that first phase of seeking safety and stability is critical to lay that foundation to get them to disclosure. Disclosure helps establish that safety and stability. But after disclosure, they begin to move into phase two, which is around grief work. And that's part of what we're focusing on in this summit. And you talk about how sometimes it's more obvious to see how the betrayed partner is facing grief. Mm-hmm. But you talk about how the addict is also going through his or her own grief process. So can you talk a little bit about what both of them, each of them, are grieving, what they've lost?
Yeah, absolutely. The betrayed partner I think their very first stage of grieving has to do with understanding what they're grieving. I've lost something. And so the level of disorientation must be so overwhelming for a betrayed partner. And so I think that particular aspect is for the betrayed partner, what am I grieving? What have I lost? What has my life been like? The disclosure information at least helps begin to situate them toward orienting that grief with some clarity. That takes significant time. The addict is a little clearer about what they're grieving at the outset because they know what they've done. And even after the disclosure, the betrayed partner will still have questions about that, which sometimes that's where a lot of the coaching comes from for the addict is how to be available to their partner when they're still asking questions, and they're going to be asking questions. They have a right to that. One of the things generally that the addict will write in the disclosure is, I want you to ask questions. I want to help orient you toward the facts of my behavior. And so it's not as if there's a reading of the disclosure and suddenly the betrayed partner is clear about what they're going to be grieving.
Sure.
They're actually still trying to sort through the facts to figure out what have they lost. The time that they've lost, the relationship they've lost, the joys that they've lost, the memories that have to be resituated and understood.
Yes,
that's extremely overwhelming for a betrayed partner. For the addict, he has some clear understanding of what he's lost, but he needs coaching around clarifying that. He knows he's lost time. He knows he's lost money. He knows he's lost real intimate relationship.
Trust.
But absolutely, that's where the trust is lost in that real intimate relationship. So he has to come to terms with how to understand precisely what he's lost. Because if it's true that an addict has avoided intimacy and now he's at this place where he's disclosed this information, If he hasn't really known what real intimacy and vulnerability is, then he doesn't really know what he's actually lost. He can know it intellectually, right? But it's when they begin to learn what is intimacy, what is vulnerability, then they look back across their life and they begin to see, wow, what I'm feeling now in this intimate moment with my partner, I could have been feeling all along. And that can be very overwhelming. But it's necessary in order for them to begin to weave their story together. And I really believe fundamentally that that the addict has got to learn how to take the lead in actually weaving the story together. And I think there are certain methods and approaches to help them do that.
That is so good. And what you're describing is a moment that I know I've seen with couples. I've seen that where the recovering addict suddenly does have this experience of closeness. Mm-hmm. And it's often in a moment where in the past, he would have tried to shut down, turn down, change the station on his partner's pain or anger or fear or whatever it is. But if he'll sit in it just long enough to feel that attunement and that connection, there can be this overwhelming sense of, oh my goodness, I could have had this all along. You said that so beautifully.
So Jake, I want to share something with you that I have been doing with men that I have seen, and in fact, just recently in a recent exercise with a client, really saw some amazing things come up. So one of the things, and I don't do it immediately after disclosure, but along the way, at some point when I think they're ready, I want them to do what is what I call an empathic narrative of their wife's perspective, an empathic narrative of their wife's perspective. I want them to be able to go into their wife's history as much as they know, even into what they know about their wife's childhood, her growing up, because sometimes a partner who's been betrayed, that's not the first time they've been betrayed.
Right.
Right. Sure. Perhaps they were betrayed by a family member, by a parent, by their first love, perhaps. And so so in order to help this client understand that, I sort of coach them around writing a narrative from their wife's perspective so that when they're saying I'll just use my wife's name, Cindy, as an example. If I were writing Cindy's perspective I would say when I was a little girl, about 7 or 8 years old, I remember my dad coming to my room and I was sound asleep. And I remember my dad yanking me out of the bed, and I can still feel myself flying across the room, landing on the floor. My dad was in this rage and he was so upset because the dogs were barking and they needed to be fed. And I, as a 7 or 8 year old child, had not done that. And there's much more to that story, but as I tell that story from my from her perspective, using the first person, that's actually a narrative way for me to slow down and begin to get a sense of what her story is like by internalizing it in words that are in first person. And it helps my perspective come a little closer to what her experience may have been. And the same thing applies. For instance, not long ago, I asked a client to tell his wife how he sees a particular event that happened in the acting out period, how he sees her leaving the house, walking to her car, getting in the car quietly, her stopping at the end of the driveway, her looking at him, and him just running back in the house and slamming the door. And as he told that story from her perspective, he had to write it down, and I coached him. And then as he read that back to me at first, you know, reading it back to me at first, he slowed down. And by the way, he started reading a little more quickly. And I said, let's just slow down a little bit. And as he slowed down, you could see some emotions begin to come up. Yeah. And then he stopped and he said, I've never done this before. I said, yeah. It's good, isn't it? It's good. Yeah. So that's when, to me, the addict begins to really embrace a clearer perspective. And that's what I mean when I talk about clarifying what you're grieving. You can't clarify what you're grieving unless you slow down and sort of walk back through the narrative from now, this new position, right? You're not acting out anymore. And by the way, if there is no sobriety, as you mentioned in the beginning, this is, you're not going to be able to do this very well, right? Because you're always going to be covering up your real emotions with shame. So I just wanted to share that.
No, that's great. So the title of your session here is How Intimacy Clarifies Grief and Empowers Growth. And so you just talked about intimacy clarifying grief because we're slowing down. You've mentioned that several times in the last few minutes, the importance of slowing down. And I do the same thing in my work with couples. I tell them at the outset of an intensive, one of the things that is going to make this time effective and meaningful is that we go very slowly. So don't have the mindset of we're going to cram in everything we can and we're going to race it. No, we're going to go slow. What? I mean, we've never talked about this, so I'm kind of going off script a little bit here.
That's okay.
What is it that is happening in that slowing down? I mean, I've got my own ideas. What is it that's so powerful about a person or a couple slowing down with emotion?
So what I think is, and my primary field of investigation is emotional labor. And emotional labor is the idea of the effort that a person makes in order to display or show an emotion that they think is expected or may be demanded of them. And so it's sort of a person having to pretend an emotion, but when in fact they're really feeling something else. And so there's this distance between what I'm really feeling and what I'm acting like I'm projecting to feel. Addicts are very familiar with that. They might not know that, but you know, when an addict is acting out, they're obviously projecting a lot of things, right? But when in reality, they're feeling shame, they're feeling distance, they're feeling isolation, condemnation, all those guilt and all those other feelings that are very self-destructive. So I think what happens is that gap, when you slow down, I think the gap between the intellectual understanding and the neurological response begins to close, right? But you have to slow down.
Right.
And so one of the main things that addicts will say to me, particularly right after disclosure, and of course, their wives and partners may still be very activated, obviously, and asking lots of questions and being having these triggers or what I call activation points. And they will say, you know, when is she going to get over it? When is she going to get by it? I've owned it, and I'm not going to act out again. I'm going to keep working the program, and it hurts me to see her hurt, and I just don't know how much longer I can take it. And that is them being fearful of closing that gap.
Right? That's good.
I don't know if I can close that gap. And when I hear them say that, I'm like, you know, if I can help you close that gap, you're going to love slowing down. You're going to love it, because then you're going to feel something that is deeply humanizing, meaningful, purposeful, and it's connecting. It's intimacy. I'm feeling something with her. I can't feel exactly, and this something has to be said here. I cannot feel exactly what she feels. I'm not her.
Right. Right. Right.
Empathy is not the ability to feel what somebody else is exactly feeling.
Right.
But it does involve feeling something about what they're feeling, so that there is this empathic, I like to call it, this empathic exchange. I see you. And then she sees that I see something about what she's feeling.
That's right.
And in that, and another aspect of this, by the way, of closing that gap, slowing down, is the gaze.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
A client the other day mentioned that, you know, he was able go out with his wife to a restaurant. He found the perfect place. And so his back was turned to the crowd, and he said, you know, I just wanted to look at her the whole time. And he said, something happened in me that I never felt before. And you know, now these things don't just happen. They happen in the process, right? We don't force them to happen, but we have to put ourselves in a place for them to happen, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, yeah. That's so good. That's so good. And I agree that gaze is critical. It's critical. It's amazing to me when I'm working with couples and I'm trying to understand what their normal daily practice is. And I'm often, you know, trying to like, give me a glimpse, give me a picture of conflict for the two of you when, you know, you're triggered, you're activated. And I ask questions like, where are you? Where are you relative to each other?
Where are you standing?
Are you standing? It's amazing to me. They're not looking at each other. They're across the room from each other. They're doing other things at the same time.
Exactly right.
Yeah. And
yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, just sitting down. Yeah. Just sitting down face to face and slowing down is a game changer. There's so much data there.
Yes, there is.
Yeah.
There is. So I got a couple of things I've got to say if I can remember them here, but so absolutely, I'll investigate that. And so I have a process that I call reliving to learn, reliving to learn. And so what I ask guys to do is, many times they'll share with me a scenario where she came in and she said this and it was a great day. And then suddenly everything just went south or spiraled out of control.
Yep.
And by the way, nothing ever just spirals out of control. There's a stimulus somewhere that's creating that. Something going on, or maybe stimuli, many, many different points that are activating both her and you in this discussion. But he'll say, you know, I will do what you're talking about, you know, where are you standing and so forth. And so in this reliving to learn process, I will have them walk back through and say, and actually revisit, as I say, let's revisit the scene of the crime. Can we do that?
Yes.
The scene of where this happened. And so a few years back, one gentleman said, you know, I did that. I coached him to do this. And so he went back to the fireplace. He was standing by the fireplace, you know, and she was in the other room. And he said, okay. So then at one point in this reliving to learn, I'll say, let's re-script that. If we had an opportunity to do it over now, what would it look like if we were in this vulnerable place? Okay. And so, so walking back through that and just coaching them through what I could have said, it's not about shaming. It's not about, I should have done this. It is about learning.
Right.
That's why I love being a coach. You know, what do you do as a coach? You tell your players to practice. If you practice well, you're going to play well. And the second thing I want to bring up about that, Jake, is that a lot of guys will invariably ask me, it was a very common question when we get to this point. They will say, well, I feel like that's not authentic. I feel almost like I might be seeking to manipulate her. That's a very good question.
Yeah, and good on them for being aware of it,
right,
and not wanting to do it.
Oh, thank you for asking that. An excellent question. So let's talk about what is authenticity. Where does it come from, right? Now, obviously, as an addict, you were never very authentic to begin with. So let's just be clear about that, right? I'm acting out, and then I'm coming home and acting like I'm in love, right? I'm going to doing this stuff, and I'm acting like I'm really connecting, when in fact,
right,
truthfully, I'm not, because I'm deeply, deeply feeling all these dark things inside of me. So let's be honest about that. That was not authentic. No, they will say, absolutely, that was not authentic. But this feels awkward. This feels different, trying to do this. And so... So what I'll say is I really do believe that it depends on the motivation, and not only the motivation, but what is the point of doing this? What are your values around doing
this? That's right.
Right. If I value my relationship with this woman that I've hurt, and I know that my approach has been detrimental to her and also detrimental to me, is it really inauthentic to practice a different approach? So my answer to that is no, it's not inauthentic, that question. But the other thing is that there's a part of me that's making it feel more inauthentic. And that is, I'm not accustomed to talking in a softer voice. I'm not accustomed to situating my body so that I'm staring at her in the face.
Yes.
That's where the awkwardness is. And it's like a football player or, you know, a wide receiver who's used to catching the football over his right shoulder, and he's 90% effective with catching football over his right shoulder. And the coach says, look, I got to run you down the other side of the field over there. You need to learn how to catch it over your left shoulder. And the guy says, coach, it just feels so awkward.
Yeah.
It feels awkward. Yeah. Why? Because I'm learning something new. But
it's different.
Is it worth it?
Yeah.
If it's worth it, it's not inauthentic.
That's right.
I'm willing to do
That's
this.
Right.
It's worth it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's about the why. It's why are you doing this? Right? I'm because I'm wanting to be authentic in this way. I'm wanting this to be the man I become. You know? Right.
Yeah, and there's several choices. Several areas where we get information from which we process and make decisions. Emotions is one of them. And the way I distinguish emotions and feelings, and I simplify these things for me to understand. But for me, an emotion is a thought that generates chemicals in the brain. That's an emotion. A feeling is the sensation of those chemicals impact on your body. So an emotion is a thought that generates the chemicals, and then the feeling or the sensation. This is why you therapists will often ask, and sometimes I do, you know, how's your stomach feeling right
now? Yeah. What are you noticing in your body? Yeah.
What are you noticing in your body? And so so when they learn that, that also helps them close the gap between what they're thinking and what they're feeling. And
right.
Many times, because of the addict's experience, particularly with dissociation and compartmentalizing, that distance is very great, right? Again, they have to slow down and become
right.
aware of, you know, what? This is making me feel something. So if I slow down and breathe into that, and if I can relive this to learn it in a different way. So let's just go back to the guy that's redid this and went back to the fireplace. The house was empty. Nobody was around. I said, I want you to picture it as closely as you can, just as it happened. Would you close your eyes? Picture her face. Picture. Now listen, hear her voice, what she said. Now, when you do that in the practice, what's going to happen is your neurological system will actually come online in a similar way that it did in the actual event, right? That's interesting. It won't be as intense.
Sure.
Right? It won't, but it will still start to come online. And guys have come back and said, it happened. It really happened. I said, okay, now because you're there, you're by yourself, take a breath. And say, okay, I could move toward her. I could sit down. I could hold out my hands open, and I can say with a different voice. And then as you practice it that way, because you brought your neurological system online through going back through it, you're actually teaching your neurological system to behave differently, aren't you?
That's right. That's
the more
right.
You do that, the better you get, and the more real and natural it feels, the more the emotions really do come on you, and the more you feel connected. And that's how those behaviors empower the growth, right? When you do that, when you clarify the grief by going to your wife, let's just do a quick scenario.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's just say your partner comes home, she's triggered or she's activated about something. And you've done the practice, all right? You've practiced this, you've practiced through other scenarios. And the moment that she's activated, you see that, and guess what? Your neurological system starts getting up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Your breath gets shorter, your stomach gets tighter, your shoulders get more tense, less oxygen going to your brain. And so you know that, you've practiced it. So what do? You take a breath and you say to her, using my wife's name, say to her, "Hey, Cindy, can we sit down for just a minute? I really want to hear what you're going through," right? And if you can't do that if you haven't practiced it.
Mm.
If you wait for that moment, you keep waiting for it to get better, it's not going to get better if you don't practice.
That's
right. And when I tell partners this, by the way, few of them ever ask me the question about, well, that seems like he would be so inauthentic. No, few of them ever ask me that question. And you know why? Because they want their partners, their addict partner, to rise to the occasion to say, "I want to be different because you are worth it."
That's exactly right. You're worth the effort, changing the behavior, expanding these emotional capacities. And I'm right with you. Most of the time, the betrayed partner is not questioning that. Well, she may be questioning the authenticity, but she doesn't mind the awkwardness of it.
Right.
Now,
that's right.
The few times where I have had someone say, "Well, you know, you just told him what to do. He's just doing exactly what you told him to do." What I usually respond is I ask her at that point very gently, mm-hmm. "Who else would he have learned this from?" And that taps into their own compassion usually, because they usually know the story of their addicted partners, right? And mm-hmm. all of us, we were out the other night, Wendell, and I believe we talked about Vygotsky and the zone of proximal development and scaffolding. All of us need help learning new things.
Thank you.
Right? You can't learn in isolation. A book isn't even in isolation because somebody wrote that book, right? Somebody recorded that video. And so that's what we're helping these guys do, is learning a skill that maybe they never were taught or shown, or it was never modeled before them. That's really, really good stuff. Now let's turn just a little bit and talk about the empowering of growth. And so we're talking about grief. And people think about grief and they're like, "Grief is terrible. It's painful. It's, you know," but I always say grief is where the healing happens. Mm-hmm. And grief is a meaning-making process. That's fundamentally what it is. So can you connect those dots a little bit about how it is that intimacy around the grief helps empower growth?
Addiction keeps people in isolation, keeps people in shame. When they come to terms with it and move toward relational healing, it's in the connecting, it's in the emotional, it's in the sharing of the grief. It's not just I'm grieving as an addict what I've lost. I'm grieving as a betrayed partner what I've lost. It's when he has the audacity, and which is a great word. I often say that's the reason why we call this place Daring Ventures. Okay.
That's right.
It's a very daring thing.
Absolutely.
To move toward intimacy when you're thinking about loss. An example of a conversation, and this would probably be more of a crystal pure kind of conversation, you know, okay, between an addict and the partner he betrayed, would be, "Hey, Cindy, I want to talk to you about what you've lost. And And I want you to just tell me.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I'll even make some notes if that's okay. Because I want something I can look at and reflect on and think about. Now, what's he saying? He's saying, I want to share your grief.
So that's right.
Sharing of the grief that empowers the growth, right? If I'm over here saying I'm a bad person, I did these things, you know, this is what I've lost. I lost time. I lost money. I lost intimacy. You know, I lost connection. You know, I lost the respect of my children, whatever. I can go through. There's a ton of things that you lose.
Sure, sure.
But if I don't share my grief, then my grief is always about me.
Mm.
Right? And this is difficult for the betrayed partner. But it is a critical step forward in the healing of the relationship when the addict can listen to the grief without bearing the shame. I want to hear what you lost.
That's right.
Now, the only way that one can do that without bearing the shame is fundamentally to know that they're not that person anymore. They don't want to be that person. They're working a great recovery. They're checking in, they're growing, learning about themselves, they're identifying their character flaws, and they're working on developing. And that's a lifetime journey, by the way. And so if they're in that place, then they can build the capacity, the audacity, the daring, the daringness to be able to lean into their partner and say, hey, I want to share what you've been through. And again, that has to do with listening to and understanding the story. When I say understanding the story, I think even being able to say it back.
Absolutely. Yeah.
The grieving partner. Absolutely. Be able to say, you know, what you just described, I really do want to get a view of that in my mind. What it was like, you know, what it was like for you the day that I left the house and you were there alone with our new baby. I'm just thinking about you, looking at the walls. And I want to help guys capture that language. They're capable of doing it. They need help, like you say. And some people may say, well, why do they need help? Well, because we all need help. That's right. That is the nature of vulnerability, in my opinion. The essence of vulnerability is to be able to say, I need help.
I need help.
I don't know how to do this. Can you help me?
Yeah. You know, back when I first started working with couples, when I got into this profession, I swore I'd never work with couples. That was not, you know, I had no desire to do it. And here I am. It's all I do now. And I love it. But one of the things that I noticed when I began working with couples on a little more wider scale was that there were certain couples where they were getting 2, 3, 4 years out post disclosure. And the addicted partner was sober, in recovery, you know, working a program. The betrayed partner had experienced a lot of healing from the initial trauma of the betrayal, you know, even into some post-traumatic growth. And they'd still split. They would still split. And I began to, you know, get curious about that and ask questions and talk to other colleagues about it. And what you're describing is what is the conclusion that I arrived at eventually myself, which is that these couples, they had grieved individually.
Yeah.
'Cause you're going to grieve your brain. I mean, if you don't grieve, that's its own DSM diagnosis of complicated grief. That's a different thing. You're going to grieve. You're going to move through and you're going to create meaning. You're going to put a story together to launch out into that next chapter. Couples that weren't sharing their grief, even if they got better, ended up splitting. And I think it was because grieving together gives the shared story.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
So the guy says, hey, she just keeps bringing it up. I mean, we're three years down the road. And she's not doing it as much, but she keeps bringing it up. And the other day, I just told her, look, can we just get past this? And I said, so let's don't say that. He said, but why not? He said, you know, isn't it time to move on with our lives? I said, you are going to move on with your life, and it's going to be a whole life. It's going to be wonderful. Here's what can happen when she brings it up. See it as an opportunity to grieve together.
That's right.
And if I can coach you how to do that, If I can give you examples, if I can model for you, if you know, whatever I can do to help you be in that moment, and then you're going to have to practice it because you know she's going to bring it up again, right? So might as well practice. And so if you can practice and say, and stop, well, we might be late for the reservation. It's okay, there'll be another reservation. You know, what's the priority? Well, the movie starts at 8 o'clock. It's okay, they got 30 minutes of stuff they're going to show anyway. And so what? You know, stay and you'll see the movie later. In other words, there's so many things that distract us that we think are critical. And most of the reason why we think they're critical is because we're afraid of the pain. Mm. Step into it. It'll be all right.
That's right.
You know, somebody had some shoulder surgery recently. And the doctor says, well, you got to do this therapy. And the guy says, well, I can't do it. He says, why not? And the guy says, well, it's just too painful. Oh, what did the doctor say? Well, you're going to have to breathe into that pain. You're going to have to walk through the pain because to make it better, you have to work it. And so there's lots of little examples and that many of us can think of. The same thing applies here. If we want to grow, we have to step into the pain. Not ill-equipped. That's why you need help. Learn the strategies, practice the strategies. But as you do, I think that you will be empowered toward growth in your relationship.
Yeah. And, you know, we can talk about this all day long and give all the theory and everything, but there's nothing like the felt experience.
Yeah.
Right. Of doing what you're describing. One of the things that I often have couples do is when I'm trying to help them do grief work and the betrayed partner's pain is swelling, you know, or her fear is swelling, excuse me. Yeah. And I see the activation in the one who did the betraying, and I see the pulling away, eyes down, maybe turning away, shoulders slumping. One of the things I often do is I say, will you try something? Are you willing to just try this? Don't even think of it. Just do what I say. Don't think about it. Let's just see what it feels like afterward. Sit up, lean forward, look her in the eye. Now say this, I'm not going to leave you in the pain that I caused you. I'd rather be with you in your pain than not with you at all. And the way they light up, the empowerment that they feel in that moment, I've seen that be like a paradigm shift for some of these guys. And that's what you're describing.
Yes, absolutely. And what you're doing in session, I'm going to do with them individually and coach them, model, role play. You know, a role play with guys. Sometimes I'll role play with a guy and he will get to pretend to be her.
Mm.
And I'll pretend to be him. I had a client recently where that really hit him. He said, damn, I've been really mean to her. He said it with tears.
Yeah. Because
he was getting to pretend to be her for a moment, which is part of that empathic growth. Absolutely.
Yeah. That's so good. That's so good. So we've kind of talked around this a little bit, but let's just try to, you know, address this in a really clear way. So a couple, they're in this grief phase. They're wanting to move into growth. What's a relationship going to look like during that time?
Well, it's going to feel very ambivalent. It's going to, you know, with what a lot of guys say, man, I'm on the roller coaster. You know, sometimes it feels like I'm just gliding along and things are good. And sometimes I'm just inching up the hill and not sure if I'm going to make it to the top.
Mm.
Sometimes I feel like I'm free falling and I have no idea what's going to happen. So, it's going to be that way simply because of the emotional uncertainty, the lack of clarity. Again, you're as an addict and this is true to a greater or lesser extent, I believe, for every addict coming into recovery and then working on relationship recovery, is because every addict is going to be learning what authenticity is, what vulnerability is, what connection is, what being together in pain. Intimacy is not just about being happy together and oh boy, we just love each other. Intimacy is about sharing the joys and the sorrows of life. It's about sharing the little things and the big things, the shallow things and the deep things. It's about sharing your whole self, right? And so when a person is learning integrity, when they're learning the full integration of self, then they're learning how to share that self. So it's in the learning. You know, I mean, if you and I were to go out and practice something that we don't know how to do very well, it's going to be messy. Okay. But the more we practice, the more we're committed, the more we show up, the less messy it's going to look. And so, so I think that the couples need to give themselves space for learning and growing and be able to look at each other and say, hey, we're growing through this, but we're committed to walking forward. And so, yeah, I do think that absolutely, if the relationship is growing, it's going to be messy. There has to be room sometimes for do-overs. I think a betrayed partner, and actually most betrayed partners I've met, are very gracious.
Absolutely.
They really are.
Yes.
They're still there because they want to have a relationship with this person who has horribly, horribly hurt them, right? And so that's not to heap shame on the addict here. It's just to help them see that there's opportunity. There is
that's
opportunity,
right.
And there's potential going forward. So yeah, I think that a relationship that is in healing, it's not going to be a linear progression. It's going to be like this.
Mm-hmm.
But you hope that over months and certainly over years that there is a move upward toward that
right.
kind of co-regulation and emotional attunement that's happening between the two of them. And I think the critical component for that is learning how to grieve together.
Oh, that's good. It's very, very good. All right. One last question. So there's an addict, a recovering addict listening. He's thinking right now, man, I want that. I want to be able to do that. That sounds good. Give him one thing. What's the first step he could take? One thing to do to move into this?
Surrender. There it is. It's really the first step in recovery. Surrender to the process of learning vulnerability.
Mm.
Being able to say, I don't know how to be vulnerable, but I want to learn. And
wow.
Letting somebody teach you. I would say that is, it is the first step. If you miss that first step, everything else is not going to work. And it's the same thing in any 12-step program. Being willing to say, And obviously, you know, in a 12-step program, you see that your life is unmanageable. The second step is surrender. So you've already seen your life is unmanageable. So that's an accepted thing. So really, it's that second step in the 12-step program. But here you apply it to the relationship and saying and admitting to yourself, I don't know how to be truly in an intimate relationship. I've been afraid of it my whole life. I'm unsure how to do it. Oh, I pretended I could do that, right? To experience the real substance of it, I would say the one thing to do is surrender to the process of learning how to be vulnerable.
Wow. Yeah. Thank you, Wendell. This has been great. I always love spending time with you, brother. And if you're watching this and you want to contact Wendell or get a hold of him, you've got a website down there that you can reach out and hear about what he does, the work he does with men. It's really phenomenal. Thank you, Wendell. Thank you all
Thank
of
you
for listening. And we'll see you soon.
You've been listening to Betrayal Recovery Radio, the official podcast of APSATS. If you've received help or hope from this episode, I encourage you to share it with someone you know. If you've not yet done so, please subscribe to our podcast on your favorite listening platform. Thank you for joining us. I'm Dr. Jake Porter, and you can always email me directly at jake@apsats.org. I'd love to hear your ideas, questions, or comments about the show. Until next time, keep choosing to use your voice and live your values. It's good for you and for this world.